I think this is a good time for me to talk about one aspect of your film that I like a lot, which is you intersperse and contextualize the Camden episode with shots of Camden today, and also a Vietnam documentary footage of the actual military operations in Vietnam. I wanted to ask John, what sort of effect seeing these on television or reading accounts, in increasingly critical accounts in newspaper, even in mainstream newspapers, what kind of effect did that have on you and your motivation to do something like this and your the development of your political consciousness?
Well, actually, I was in the Navy from 64 to 68. I joined the Navy right after the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And when I went in, nobody even knew what Vietnam was. We did not know. We in the active duty military did not know what Vietnam was. There were some things on bulletin boards in the barracks, and you kind of look at them and say, oh, well, you know, what's going on over there? What's that all about? By the time I got out in 68, it was the biggest issue in the country. LBJ had already admitted that he cannot run for re-election. I mean, it was just huge. We were thinking 1968. I got out in August of 68. So while I was in, I became more and more aware of what was going on there. And I actually supported the war the first 2 years I was in. And the last 2 years I was in, I did not. But, of course, I did not want to desert or anything. I did my 2 years and got out. And immediately, instantly, within a month, got in touch with the anti-war movement. I don't remember exactly how. But it was actually Catholics. And, you know, it just dragged on and on and on. And actually, let's see, I got out in 68, March 69, like I said, was the DC-9 action. And that's where I really ran into people who were really doing something. Before then, I was just kind of doing paperwork at Catholic Peace Fellowship. We were doing draft counseling and things like that, and helping fellows get their conscientious objector status and not go to that war. But I really wanted something more hands-on. I mean, well, the thing was dragging on. It was on television every night, and there was this huge anti-war movement swelling up, getting larger and larger. It was just all around us. I mean, people listening today who were not living at that time cannot imagine how huge this issue was. It permeated our entire lives. It was a lead story on every newscast every night for years. It was in every paper, front page. And it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And the songwriters and everybody, you know, it was just, you tuned into Sunday night TV and there it was, you know, the Smothers Brothers or whoever, you know, singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy or whoever was doing that, you know. And it just totally surrounded us. You couldn't get away from it. Could not get away from it.
Do you think today there's some desensitizing, I guess, I can only speculate on reasons why, but I think sometimes when you know people hear that a military operation will be carried out in X country, and many have in the past decade, it doesn't really seem to resonate sometimes. I think part of the reason why is when you actually watch TV, you sometimes just only see military talking heads or policy quote-unquote experts talking about it, and it really feels more like a policy decision on paper rather than an actual bombing that destroys human life. Do you feel that today that it doesn't really permeate people's consciousness, and are you alarmed by that?
No, it doesn't really. It's not as huge. You know, we're somewhat, I guess, isolated from it. You know, it's been justified because of what happened on the 11th of September a couple of years ago. People figure that, well, we need to be over there. We need to do this sort of thing. It's not my kids dying. Right now we don't have a draft. And boy, if anything can be said about the draft, it's good. That is that it does take middle-class people into the military, and suddenly the war is out in the suburbs. It's not just lower-income people who need to go into the military that are being picked off and killed. You know, right now with the way it's set up right now with the volunteer services, you don't have fairly well-off middle-class kids going over there. So everybody who's generally sitting around watching the TVs or reading the papers feels that it's not really touching me, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hate to say that because, you know, we use the draft boards as a symbol of the war, and we really did want to stop that war and stop those draft boards from functioning. But on the other hand, And even Ted Kennedy said this years and years and years ago. You know, when you end the draft, it'll only be poor people going into the service. And as much as I hated to admit it, you know, he was somewhat right. So people can sit there and say, well, it's not my little Johnny or Mary that has to go into the service. And they can feel separated from it. But when it starts to affect us more and more and more, if we're in there and stuck in Iraq for a long, long time, there will be a groundswell. It'll take time. I mean, talking about resolution was, what, 64?
Yep.
The first major demonstration was, I think, in New York, maybe in 67, and then the huge one at the Pentagon in October 67. You know, so that took 3 years alone for people to really start waking up, and then just took off from there.
Let me ask you, before we turn to, I guess, the second part of the film and the story in general, let me just ask you about the moment you guys were caught. I know not everyone in the Camden 28 was present that night. Were you present that night?
I was. I was over at Myra Billman's house.
Okay.
And about a block away.
Can you talk about, I guess, basically very straightforwardly, what happened?
Yeah, I was on a walkie-talkie type radio communicating with Paul Cooming, who was actually inside the building. There were eight people inside the building. I could see the building from where I was, and there were a few of us over at Milo's house. We had gotten people in the building, and then we retreated to various places. And we were watching the building and in contact from Milo's house, like I said, about a block away, and waiting for the action to pretty much be over, and then we would have to go and get these folks out, which meant, you know, driving up vehicles and, you know, affording them a way to actually get away from the area. And all of a sudden I saw the lights going on in the building. It was on the top floor, or second floor from the top, and I could see the lights going on. And I thought, my God, what the heck are they doing over there? They're turning the lights on. At the same time, Paul was on the radio to me saying, and probably even seconds before the lights came on, he said, there's a guard coming, there's a guard coming. And then all of a sudden he said, the guard's here, and the lights came on. And I'm not sure it exactly happened that way. In fact, I think I saw the lights come on before he said, he's here, he's here. And within seconds, since Miles' house was a typical inner-city row house, the front and back doors were kicked in, and a bunch of guys came running in yelling, FBI, FBI, you know, that type of thing. And I was still sitting there on the radio talking to Paul. I said, they're here too, you know. And we still didn't know what happened or why. How did they find us here? You know, I could understand them stumbling on people in the building if a guard had seen them or whatever. But how did they find us here? And they just one by one took us into custody. You know, it wasn't as scary as one would think it would be. Probably because there's just so much going on, you don't have time to be scared.
Right.
You really don't. And, you know, and they take immediate control of each person. And there was a guy right on me, facing me, and just pointing right in my face, and you just stay there. You don't move, you know. And I still had the radio in my hand, and he took the radio from me. And eventually they stood me up, frisked me, cuffed me, put me in a car. And each of us were driven around for quite a while they collected other people. While I was in the car, I could hear them talking about who they're still looking for and what vehicles they're still looking for. And I thought, man, these guys know where everybody, or who, anyhow, they're looking for, who everybody is in the action, and what vehicles we're driving. Somebody tipped them off. Just from the information that was going on their radio, in their car. You know, I'm sitting in the back seat handcuffed. But I'm thinking, man, somebody told them everything that's going on. And eventually we were brought to the federal building, which is the same building where the draft board was, one by one, taken into separate rooms and interrogated for a long time. And none of us spoke. None of us told him a thing, really. We just, you know, hung together, as we were told, you know, by Ben Franklin, you hang together or you hang separately. So we just hung together, really. Eventually we were, and I'm really, you know, jumping in here, this is the short version. Eventually we all ended up in a cell block together, I think in the basement of that building somewhere. And we looked around, and there was one person missing.
Who will remain unknown to our listeners?
Anonymous at this point.
Yeah.
I was going to leave that up to you, Anthony. It's your call on that.
No, well, we were talking about it beforehand. We kind of said that, well, sort of not mention who it was.
Yeah, okay.
Let's talk about some of the pretrial preparations. You know, you mentioned it seems like you guys were reasonably collected as you can be after being arrested for something like this. But, you know, when it came time to actually face the courtroom, can you talk about what was going on in your mind and what sort of things you were doing to prepare a defense, and what kind of, you know, what sort of defense, the nature of the defense that you were plotting out at the early, in the early stages of the trial?
Yeah, Anthony, you want to talk about what happened leading up to the trial?
Yeah, you know, I do. I was wondering if I could just backtrack for 1 second, because I think there's one piece of information that was left out, and that was it's connected to the FBI. But you know, why would the FBI be so interested in this group?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously they don't want people breaking into draft boards. They don't want, you know, them you know, impeding the draft system. But there was something that happened in March of 1971. You know, months before the. The Cannon 28 action, that was that in Media, Pennsylvania, a group of activists, and to this day they don't know who did it, but broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, is a local one, and removed hundreds of documents. And basically what these documents revealed was is that how the FBI was harassing and spying on the anti-war movement. And these documents were circulated to the press, to members of Congress, and basically blew open this this COINTELPRO program that you've maybe, you know, heard about recently because of these recent revelations that the FBI is now sort of spying on the anti-war movement, the current anti-war movement. They say it sort of revives memories of the COINTELPRO program, which stands for Counter, I think, Intelligence Program. You know, basically trying to break up leftist organizations, the anti-war movement, placing informers within groups. And this was, I think, to say that Hoover was outraged was is an understatement. you know, I mean, this was something really personal. And, you know, we've interviewed an FBI agent who was involved in Cannon 28 case about the media. You know, we talked about it, and he said that this was very, very personal to Hoover, that, that he wanted heads, basically. Who did this? Who broke into the FBI? You know, this is me that you're invading. And the fact that they couldn't find them was a constant source of embarrassment for the FBI. That fact, that they couldn't determine who did media, I think coupled with the sort of stumbling case in Harrisburg, you know, not really being able to prove that that Dan and Phil Berrigan were trying to kidnap Henry Kissinger and blow up tunnels underneath Washington. You know, they were sources of embarrassment for the FBI, for the Justice Department. And Hoover wanted heads. And when they found out, they caught on to the fact that the Camden action was happening, the FBI figured, well, these must be the same people that did the media office, because it sort of is the, you know, the same MO, you know, I mean, the way that it was sort of, I'm assuming it was just, you know, cased, but the way it was stolen was very similar to the way the draft boards were done. So, you know, the, and this sort of leads into the trial, the, you know, the government was, I would say, less interested in what happened to the draft records in Camden and more interested in catching the people who were doing it. So, you know,
in fact, they were very gleeful. The next morning, John Mitchell, who was head of the Department of Justice, Attorney General under Richard Nixon, and J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI at that time, had a joint press conference announcing that we have broken the backs of the East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives, which was a name they had given generally to the whole action community. In fact, it was really the name of one group in one city. But they were just so happy with that. And then within a week or so, it seems to me, looking back on it, and I can't remember whether it was Rochester or Buffalo, there was another action, and they called themselves a new and improved East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives. And basically, we said, you can't stop us.
Yeah.
You know, but they were happy. Oh, they just gleeful.
And
I think Anthony's right on that, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the informer was asked, you know, find out what you can about media. You know,
yeah.
And I sort of have a feeling that, you know, this is maybe the reason why it sort of went on so long, you know, or I could say why you weren't arrested. I mean, you know, if the informer goes to, you know, the FBI, you know, and sort of knows what's going on, I mean, I don't see why they could have just arrested them immediately, but they sort of like, you know, let it go on and on to sort of, you know, draw the net as wide as they could, to see who's going to be brought into this Camden action, because maybe they're going to tell us.
Even the night of action, they allowed it to go on for 2 or 3 hours.
That's right. I mean, they were all in place. They were in the building, for over 2 hours, destroying draft records. I mean, probably 10 feet away, hiding.
They could have gotten us on as many counts as they did when the first person tore the first record.
Or broke into the window.
In that office.
Right? I mean, what about even breaking into the draft board?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean,
to this day, I think they wanted us to go into the FBI office and then say, we caught the people who did media.
That's
and
right.
Of course, we didn't. As soon as I told... Actually, Paul and I, I'm just going from memory now, Paul was saying, hey, we're getting ready to come out. And it was clear the action was drawing to a close, and it was almost over. And that's when the feds busted all of us.
That's
they
right.
Said, shit.
Went sort of
They're
word.
Not going to go in the FBI office. Let's get them now.
Yeah, yeah. And, there was an FBI office in that building.
Yeah.
There was an Army intelligence office in that building. It seems kind of strange, when you think about this. But that the draft board, they were all in the same building. So, I sort of view this as, like I said, less sort of interested in the pieces of paper there that they were sort of supposed to be protecting, and more interested in making a point and solving. And, nobody said anything about media. There was no, in fact, some of the early news reports at the time was, that they captured the ringleader of the media raid, who they pinned John Grady was one of the Camden 28. They were never able to prove that. And in fact, I think there were even some retractions in the in the newspapers in the the following days.
And they were so interested in this. This went all the way up to the White House. H.R. Haldeman was getting, I guess, between he and Kissinger or whatever, notes were going back and forth. Kissinger was National Security Advisor. H.R. Haldeman was Chief of Staff for Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And I mean, this entered the White House. They were that interested in this action.
And if I, now that you're mentioning the White House, I got the FBI file through the Freedom of Information Act, and you can see on the files, and John pointed this out to me, I didn't notice it first, you look at the FBI files, and there's a stamp on there. What does it say? Reviewed by the White House? Something like that, right?
Yeah, when we were up in New York looking at it.
There's a stamp on their file saying reviewed by the White House. And in fact, the action happens on the 22nd of August. There was a dry run the weekend before on the night of the 14th, and everybody was, the FBI was there. Everybody was in place, okay, apparently ready to arrest them, and the arrest doesn't happen that night. And the FBI informer basically asked his contact, I thought this was going to happen tonight, and they told him that, somebody in the little White House in California didn't want it to happen. They want them to actually, didn't want them to get arrested until they actually broke into the building. So the little White House was...
I didn't believe that for years until I saw the documents with Haldeman and Kissinger's name on.
Oh, you said you didn't believe it?
No, I thought he was just being, flamboyant. Yeah, the little White House, because he can be a little flamboyant.
Sure.
And I thought, come on, he's imagining. The White House, give me a break. But then I saw the documents at your apartment up there in New York.
Yeah.
And I thought, holy smokes.
Yeah.
This is really true.
Yeah. So, you can see that it's a small, city, Camden, New Jersey, but the significance that it had, to the White House,
So were you nervous going into the trial? Can you talk about how your mindset at the start of it?
Well, let me ask Anthony now here one quick question.
Yeah.
Should I say anything about any papers that may have been signed before we went to trial, and what effect that had?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, part of the trial, so we should.
Because eventually, what the informant did, and a number of things led up to this. Let me just say, because I think it goes to our credit, that shortly after we got out of jail, I visited him the first day right out of jail.
The
informant.
Yeah.
And basically said, okay, why'd you do it? And he gave me some BS reasons. He was trying to protect the younger people in the group and all this other kind of stuff. He thought we older people who had been involved in other actions were just drawing younger people in and, all that kind of stuff. But then a short while after that, his son fell out of a tree in front of their house and impaled himself on an iron fence. And he died. And this was a big thing, very heavy. And as I recall, I say most of us. Some people say, no, there weren't that many, you know, but at least more than half of us, I think, showed up at the funeral of the son of the guy who had gotten us arrested. And Father Michael Doyle said the funeral mass. And it was just a powerful moment where, you know, all of us were there. And some people in the community had said, well, that's God's way of punishing this informant. And we said, no, God doesn't throw little boys out of trees. Give me a break. No, that's not what's going on here at all.
And
I guess maybe that had something to do with him turning around. But eventually he filed an affidavit in the federal court. He worked very closely with one of our lawyers, David Carries, who still practices in Philly. And in the affidavit, he claimed not just to be an informant, but an agent provocateur, an agent and a provocateur. And the one great line in that affidavit says that this action would not have happened without me in the FBI. And in the affidavit, he described how every time we needed something, he came up with it. And if he didn't have it, he would go to the FBI and say, well, they need money, they need this, they need that. And the FBI would supply it. They would give it to him, and he would give it to us. And we really didn't think twice, because the guy ran a small home improvement business, and we thought, yeah, well, he's got access to the tools and a little extra money and stuff like that. But basically, the FBI was making sure the action happened. And the informant said that in the affidavit. Well, here we are in 7 federal felony counts. This thing is filed, and we're wondering, where is this going to go? The feds say, well, we don't care. We're still going to go to trial. But the first day of trial, they offered us, the federal government, offered us a walk if we would cop a plea to 1 misdemeanor. Well, that's a far cry from 7 federal felony counts.
And 47 years in prison.
Right. And basically, we said, well, we've got to talk about this. And the judge was very good, Judge Clarkson Fisher, who I still respect, and the federal building up there in Trenton is named after him. He said, okay, you guys, you got the courtroom for your big meeting, because we had some, you know, of our close advisors in there also. We basically, everybody was out of the courtroom except us, and we had a pretty long meeting, and we talked about it all, because some people wanted to take the plea, and others said, no. And we decided to go to trial. And there was that moment when everybody returned to the courtroom, and the judge, and I think the jury had not yet been picked. This was just like preliminary stuff going on. And I think some of our friends were in the courtroom. And in kind of a dramatic flair, you know, the judge says, okay, what's your decision? And I don't know who stood up. My recollection is Ed McGowan or somebody stood up and said, look at the prosecutor and said, we always called him John. His name was John Barry. Turned out to be a really good guy. But looked at John and said, John, call your first witness. And I was like, I can't believe they want to go on with this. And of course, that's out of place. You don't just call your first witness. But the point was, you know, very dramatic. Hey, we're going to trial. Preparing for the trial? Oh, man, I can hardly remember.
Well, I think what's interesting you can maybe talk about is this idea of co-counsel and pro se. I mean, this trial was one of the largest pro se defenses in the country, I think, up until that time, maybe even since then.
Yeah.
You know, the judge
tried to go pro se.
You went pro se, which, well, just so we can explain, basically means that, you know, pro se means that you defend yourself.
Right, literally means for yourself.
That's right, and yeah. Co-counsel meant that you were allowed to defend yourself, but also have a lawyer speak for you if you wanted.
Yeah.
And some people picked co-counsel, some people were pro se. But that's, you know, I mean, the judge didn't have to do that. The judge didn't have to allow you, or give them that opportunity.
Let me ask you for just one. Why do you think the prosecution offered you a pretty generous plea bargain?
I would assume that they and the FBI, you know, talked about this thing and said, man, we're just blown apart. We're never going to win this. I mean, we can't call the informant to the stand anymore. They're going to probably call him, and he's going to tell this story on the stand. No jury's going to let these people go. I mean, no jury's going to convict these people. You know, let's just get out from under this. They already knew what had happened in Harrisburg. That jury was hung 10-2 for acquittal. You know, they just weren't going anywhere. And this is one more case falling apart. And they just saw it fall apart right in front of their eyes. And they knew that what he said was true. You know, they could not impeach that witness.